just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it.
And to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed.
But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security.
Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government.
The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world.
He has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance, unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them.
He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only.
He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures.
He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing, with manly firmness, his invasions on the rights of the people.
He has refused for a long time, after such dissolutions, to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within.
He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands.
He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
He has kept among us, in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power.
He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation.
For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states.
For cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury.
For transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies.
For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments, for suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with the power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever.
He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people.
He is, at this time, transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation.
He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, and to fall themselves by their hands.
He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury.
A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us.
We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence.
They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends.
We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states.
That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved.
And that, as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
240 years ago today, church bells rang out over Philadelphia as the Continental Congress adopted Thomas Jefferson's draft of the Declaration of Independence. This is NPR News. Good morning, happy Independence Day, and thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8:18, and next we'll be bringing you headlines from NPR and WPR. Here how one Wisconsin school district is training its teachers to help identify whether or not a student could be victim of human trafficking. That story coming up in a couple minutes.
Support comes from Westosha Market, open Wednesday afternoons from 2:30 to 6:30 at its new location, the Kenosha County Fairgrounds. This week featuring V&K Honey, fresh unfiltered raw honey, Living Hope Farms, all organic, and Sky Mountain Kettle Corn made on site.
Celebrate the 45-year reign of Queen Elizabeth I. WPR is pleased to support music, education, and performance. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. At the White House this Independence Day, American food and festivities, as NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Like a lot of Americans, the president and first family will be hosting a barbecue this 4th of July. It's become an annual tradition. The White House invites a lot of military families out to the South Lawn. They'll be enjoying some music from Kendrick Lamar and Janelle Monáe, and they'll have a prime view of the fireworks over the National Mall. if the weather holds.
Tomorrow, President Obama expected to campaign with Hillary Clinton in North Carolina. Iraq's prime minister is pledging to put new security measures in place following the deadly weekend truck bombing in Baghdad. Officials now say more than 150 people were killed, but they warn the total is likely to increase as the search for the missing continues. Italy says it's broken up a network that has smuggled into Europe migrants from Africa. Authorities in Palermo say nearly 40 people have been detained. A NASA spacecraft is about to enter orbit around Jupiter. NPR's Joe Palca reports on the Juno spacecraft.
There are a lot of firsts on this mission. Juno is the first solar-powered mission to Jupiter. In fact, this is the farthest from Earth any solar-powered mission has gone. It'll be the first mission to orbit over the poles of Jupiter, and it'll get closer to the cloud tops of Jupiter than any previous mission, just 2,600 miles above the clouds.
The spacecraft due to fire its main rocket engine late tonight to slow itself down. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. The Eau Claire Area School District is considering having teachers be on the lookout for victims of human trafficking. A proposal introduced last week would require staff to report suspected cases of sexual exploitation to school officials and to law enforcement. Jody Emerson of the anti-trafficking group Fierce Freedom says the goal is to prevent victimization.
So we want to make sure to get the staff members the warning signs of what it looks like in the grooming process so that we can, you know, catch it before it happens.
Emerson says warning signs include students getting expensive gifts or associating with friends much older than themselves. The proposal mirrors a policy at Madison Metropolitan School District. The State Department of Corrections has treated a handful of inmates with a medication designed to combat opioid relapses. The Wisconsin State Journal reports the agency has treated 19 inmates with Vivitrol as part of a pilot program that began in April. The medication blocks opioid receptors in the brain and prevents people from getting high on opioids if they try to use them. Inmates can participate if they've been in treatment for opioid addiction while in prison and are in an earned release program and are returning to a 7-county area around Green Bay. The program's goal is to treat 100 offenders over 2 years. The current state budget lays out $1.7 million for the program. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Manhattan. Bruce Conner, It's All True, is on view with related live music performances outdoors through August. More information and tickets at MoMA.org. From Honda, maker of the restyled 2017 Accord Hybrid with 212 horsepower and a 49-mile-per-gallon EPA city rating. Available now. Learn more at accord.honda.com. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is part of every patient's treatment plan to help boost their immune system and manage side effects during treatment. More about integrative cancer care is available at cancercenter.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne. And today in your health, let's revisit a popular story aired in this segment. It's about back pain. Most Americans have a problem with it at some point. And for an unlucky third of the people in the United States, treatments don't work. And the back pain becomes chronic. There are a few places, though, where back pain hardly exists, mostly indigenous cultures far removed from modern life. In this encore, NPR's Michaeline Duclef takes us to Palo Alto, California, to visit a woman who thinks she knows why these traditional societies have such healthy backs.
After she had her first baby, Esther Gokhale couldn't even bend down to pick up her child.
I had excruciating pain. I could not sleep at night. And I was just crippled.
Gokhale had a herniated disc. Eventually, she had surgery to fix it. But a year later, it happened again.
And they wanted to do another surgery. And, you know, you don't want to make a habit out of back surgery.
Gokhale is a smart woman. She has a degree in biochemistry from Harvard, and she's a licensed acupuncturist. This time around, she wanted to think outside the box. And here's what she came up with.
Go to populations where they don't have these huge problems and see what they're doing.
Gokhale went online and searched through medical studies. She studied the work of some leading anthropologists, and she found something intriguing. Several studies of traditional populations reporting very low rates of back pain. We're talking about people who live far away from modern life. Now, most of us would have stopped there at doing research on the web, but not Gokhale. She went to the mountains in Ecuador, to tiny fishing towns in Portugal, and to the remote deserts of West Africa.
I went to villages where every kid under four was frightened to see someone with white skin.
Gokhale took photos of people who walked with water buckets on their heads, collected firewood, or sat on the ground weaving for hours.
I have a picture in my book of these two women who spend 7 to 9 hours every day bent over gathering water chestnuts. And they're not spring chickens. They're quite old. But the truth is that they don't have back problems.
She tried to figure out what all these different people had in common. And the first thing that popped out was the shape of their spines.
They have this regal posture, and it's very compelling.
And quite different than American spines. Here's an experiment. Take a friend and have them stand up and turn to their left, so you're looking at them in profile. If they have what we think of as good posture, then their spine is shaped like an S. It curves at the top and then back again at the bottom. This is what's drawn in medical books. But Gokhale didn't see those two big curves in people who don't have back pain.
That S-shaped spine is actually not natural. It's a J-shaped spine that you want.
In fact, if you look at drawings from Da Vinci or a Gray's Anatomy book from 1901, the spine isn't shaped like a curvy S. It's much flatter, almost all the way down the back. And then at the bottom, it curves to stick the butt out, so it looks more like a J. It seemed to her that this J shape was key to a pain-free back, so she developed a set of exercises to get her spine into the J shape. And gradually, her back pain went away. Then Gokhale realized she could help others. She wrote a book, set up a studio in downtown Palo Alto.
And so without further ado, welcome Esther from all of us here in Silicon Valley.
The day I caught up with her, she was giving a workshop at one of the biggest law firms in the world, Jones Day in Palo Alto. About 50 workers dressed in khakis and pencil skirts came to learn how they could sit at their computers for hours without hurting their backs. Gokhale brings a volunteer to the front to demonstrate the most common problem, the way we hold our shoulders.
Now, if we look at you from the front view, we can see that the portion of her hand that faces forward is mostly her knuckles and not so much the thumb.
Americans tend to scrunch their shoulders forward so our arms are turned in. That's not how people in indigenous cultures carry their arms.
And we're going to show you a very simple way of addressing this.
Gokhale gently takes the woman's shoulders, pulls them up, pushes them back, and lets them drop, like a shoulder roll. And then the woman's arms dangle by her side.
This is a natural architecture for our species. So it behooves us all to explore this.
Her list of clients is impressive. She's helped YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki, Matt Drudge of The Drudge Report, and she's given classes at Google, Facebook. In Silicon Valley, she's known as the posture guru. But there's still a big question. Is she right? Have people in Western society somehow forgotten the right way to stand? Praveen Mumanini knows spines intimately. He operates on them 3 times a week and co-directs the Spine Center at the University of California in San Francisco. Mumanini says scientists don't know yet why some traditional cultures have fewer problems with back pain. Nobody has done a systematic study or even documented the shape of their spines.
I'd like to go and take x-rays of indigenous populations and compare it to the Western world. I think that would be very helpful.
But Mumanini says there's a whole bunch of reasons why postures of Americans and the shape of their spines may be different than indigenous populations. For starters, Americans tend to be much heavier.
If you have a lot of fat built up in your belly, it can tend to pull your low back forward.
And that would curve the spine?
That could curve the spine, and people who are fairly thin probably have less curvature.
And thus a spine shaped more like a J than an S. Mumanini also points out that Americans are much less active than people in traditional cultures.
Do you think that that sedentary lifestyle could have an effect on the spine shape?
I think the sedentary lifestyle promotes a lack of muscle tone and a lack of postural stability because the muscles get weak.
Everyone knows that weak abdominal muscles can cause back pain. And in fact, Mumanini says that might be the secret to Gokhale's success. It's not that the J shape is the ideal one or the healthiest. It's what goes into making the J shape that matters.
You have to use muscle strength to get it to look like the J shaped spine.
So Gokhale has somehow figured out a way to teach people to build up their core muscles without them even knowing it.
You're not going to be able to go from the S to the J without having good core muscle strength, and I think that's a key here.
In other words, indigenous people around the world don't have a magic bullet for stopping back pain. They've just got beefy abdominal muscles, and their lifestyle helps to keep them that way even as they age. Michaeline Duclef,
NPR News.
Support for your health comes from Novo Nordisk, whose website actfordiabetes.com is an advocacy tool for patients with diabetes, people at risk, and others affected by diabetes. And from Athena Health, connecting providers and hospitals with EHR, revenue cycle, population health, and other services. Athena Health. Unbreak healthcare.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
The flash of July 4th fireworks is a sight to behold. But part of the spectacle is sound. While your eyes feast on lights and colors, someone has designed a performance for your ears. How it's done, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Catch All Things Considered at 4 o'clock today here on Wisconsin Public Radio and listen online at WPR.org. Good morning. It is 8:30 on this 4th of July. Hope you're having a lovely morning so far. Thanks for listening to us on Morning Edition on WPR. I'm Maureen McCollum. An advocate for a man police shot and killed after he allegedly came at an officer with a pitchfork says he struggled with mental illness for much of his adult life. Dean Lomas is executive director of Housing Initiatives and a Madison School Board member. He told the Wisconsin State Journal that Michael William Schumacher was not a dangerous person. Lomas says Schumacher has been with Housing Initiatives, which provides housing and support for people with mental illness, since 2008. He said Schumacher graduated from UW-Madison, but soon after, his mental illness began to manifest itself. He says he was legally prohibited from disclosing Schumacher's medical diagnosis. Police said they received a call on Thursday evening of a man chest deep in Lake Monona who was talking to himself. The man then threw a rock into a nearby home, went inside and started smashing things, driving the residents to flee. When police arrived, he advanced toward them, brandishing a pitchfork, ignoring commands to stop. An officer opened fire and killed him. A judge has set bail for a man accused of crashing his truck into an Army duck transport in Lake Delton nearly 2 years ago at $2,500. The Baraboo News Republic reports 32-year-old Joshua Armstrong made his initial court appearance last week. Charges related to the August 2014 crash were filed in March, but Armstrong had recently been taken into custody, and his attorney said he was not notified of the charges because he moved to a new home in Iowa. This is WPR.
Support for WPR's marketing and promotions comes from the Harold A. Engel Memorial Communications Arts Internship Fund, helping WPR employ a graduate fellow from the Wisconsin School of Business Bolt's MBA in the Arts program.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
It will be partly cloudy today in Wisconsin with highs in the mid to upper 70s, except in the lower 70s around Lake Michigan. And tonight, still partly cloudy with temperatures dropping down to the lower to mid 60s. Tomorrow, do expect rain showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from AT&T, with a network and solutions for helping companies sense and adapt to meet the demands of business. Discover the power of and with AT&T. From Diane and Hal Brierly, in support of NPR's work to engage its audience in the discussion of today's issues and provide in-depth journalism and thought-provoking stories. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. And on this 4th of July, we're remembering Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel, who died over the weekend. Wiesel survived the Nazi concentration camps Buchenwald and Auschwitz. He went on to write dozens of books, starting with his most famous, a book based on his time in the camps titled Night. Wiesel spent his life reminding the world of what Holocaust victims endured and was a driving force behind the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. President Obama called him one of the great moral voices of our time and, in many ways, the conscience of the world. Israeli columnist Nahum Barnea was a friend and a colleague, and we reached him via Skype from Tel Aviv. And may I say, Elie Wiesel famously said it was his duty to never let those who suffered be forgotten. Why do you think he was compelled to do that?
First of all, he was a teenager. He was 16 years old when he was deported first to Auschwitz and then the death march to Buchenwald. You know, he walked with his father, and his father perished in Buchenwald. So on the one hand, he was young enough to come out of the ashes and start his life from anew. But at the same time, he was in the camps for about a year, a long time. He went to Paris, to France, and there he started to write. And this, I believe, a mixture of very, very talented and intelligent, but at the same time, somebody who really felt compelled to carry this kind of message. This was the combination which allowed him to be so important in later years.
Mm. His advocacy went well beyond bearing witness to the Holocaust. At the end of his life, what were the big issues, the global issues, most important to him?
I believe that his two last campaigns, if you want, were Rwanda, demanding an end to the war and some kind of aid to the refugees. The other one was against the Iranian nuclear installations. And here, I'm not sure he was very, very happy with the deal the United States made, but he gave his best advice to President Obama to try to stop the Iranian nuclear campaign.
Mr. Wiesel was virtually never critical of Israel, at least publicly. And
right.
Some have criticized
right.
him for that. Did you ever have a conversation with him about that stance?
Yeah, sure. We had a lot of conversations about this subject in particular, because I, as a columnist writing for an Israeli newspaper, I'm quite critical of my governments. But he, from the start of every conversation, insisted that he will never do what I do because of a very simple reason. He is not living here in Israel.
Well, thank you very much for taking this time to share your thoughts about Mr. Wiesel.
Thank you very much.
Nahum Barnea is the chief political columnist for the Israeli newspaper Yediat Aharonot. Let's hear a sample of the conservative case against President Obama. An NPR team traveled much of the country talking with voters about how their lives have been over these past 8 years. The road trip led from Denver to Philadelphia, and we're hearing parts of it this week. We pick up the journey with my colleague Steve Yenske as he arrives in Kentucky.
From southern Illinois, we've now crossed the Ohio River. I'm on the south bank of it now, looking out at a barge, several of them being pushed by a tugboat. We stopped there for the night in Paducah, Kentucky. It was once a Civil War battlefield. Now it's a tourist town. We stayed in a bed and breakfast where some of the rooms were adorned with dolls in baby chairs. And in the morning, over the breakfast, we met five other travelers who were in a cheerful mood as our host served up pancakes. Some of the travelers were heading south, others were heading north. And they were about to get on the road when we asked if they would take a few questions. They included Paul Zarzasti of Marion County, Florida.
I'm actually a deputy sheriff. I've been there for 31 years.
Mm-hmm.
We have concerns with the way that the president is dividing the country. There's been some problems, you know, officers that haven't handled themselves correctly. And in any profession, you're going to have good and bad.
You're talking about these highly publicized incidents where
exactly.
A white officer shoots a black man,
right.
And riot variations on that.
And, you know, it's made our job harder for the president, you know, with his lack of support. Another thing that is a totally different subject is the illegal immigrants that are coming over, receiving these benefits when our own veterans are having to wait to receive theirs. That bothers me a lot.
In Kansas City, Kansas, we met an illegal immigrant, and he also complained. And his complaint was the opposite. His complaint was, I got this job where they're actually taking out taxes, so I'm paying taxes, but I can't get benefits. What do you guys think about that?
I understand his concern, but at the same time, whoever hired him should be held responsible for that. I mean, obviously he knows that his employee is illegal.
Some people also raise objections to immigration because they fear it's going to change the culture of the country some way. Does anybody here
No, we're all immigrants in this country.
I am a naturalized citizen. My parents came here from East Germany, and I have, especially since we were immigrants, you know, I feel for these people, but I do agree they need to do it the legal way.
That's Christiana Lemke, another of the five travelers. She sat at the table with Doug and Joyce Clark of Nebraska.
Just within the people that I know and part of my network, there's been a huge increase in the amount of people that are going out and buying firearms, handguns, ammunition, getting concealed carry permits, things like that. They're worried that, you know, with the president signing these executive orders, that those freedoms are going to be taken away from us. And I could just go on and on. I mean, I could talk all day about it.
Are you a gun owner?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And so you're concerned about your own firearms being
yes.
taken away.
Mm-hmm.
On another level, we have our sons that are employed, but we have a granddaughter who's 3 years old, and that's who we're worried about. We want to make sure that she has quality of life, that some of the quality of life that we've experienced.
Those are some of the many people heard in Steve Inskeep's Obama's Years. It's a special broadcast now on NPR stations and on the NPR Politics podcast. This is NPR News.
It is 8:41 on this 4th of July, and thank you for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be bringing you headlines next from NPR and WPR, and in 10 minutes, it's the Marketplace Morning Report.
This election year, go somewhere new.
I'm David Green in Peoria, Illinois, for our election series, The View From Here.
Explore issues on the ground.
And I stopped in a community that's confronting the question of whether the political system in the United States is broken.
And meet people from all across the country.
The revolution is happening. It was a quiet revolution. It started out, and that's why there was no big bang. It just
to understand the voices behind the votes. Listen every day.
Election coverage from NPR and WPR on air and online.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. China has sentenced a senior presidential aide to life in prison on corruption charges. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports the aide's downfall, partly due to political reasons.
Ling Jihua was an aide to former President Hu Jintao. He and ex-security czar Zhou Yongkang are the two highest officials to fall so far in China's anti-corruption drive. What Ling and Zhou had in common, besides corruption, was that they both commanded large political factions which owed allegiance more to them than to the Communist Party's leadership.
China is warning all ships to stay out of parts of the South China Sea. China is expected to begin military exercises in the region tomorrow. The drills come at a sensitive time. An arbitration court in The Hague expected to rule this month in a long-running territorial dispute with the Philippines. Nobel laureate and concentration camp survivor Ali Wiesel is being remembered as a man who not only fought for Jews, but for others as well.
He stood up for the people of Rwanda, he stood up for the Yugoslavians, he stood up for the Cambodians, and then even within the Jewish community, he was the voice that gave life to freedom of a Soviet Jewry.
Former Anti-Defamation League director Abraham Foxman speaking before a private service in Manhattan yesterday. Wiesel died over the weekend at age 87. Forecasters expect a tropical storm in the eastern Pacific to strengthen into a hurricane today. It's now centered well off the coast of Mexico. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Food shelves in northern Wisconsin tend to see more demand for food in the summer months. Department of Public Instruction Summer Food Service Program Coordinator Amy Colano says that's no surprise.
Because most typically those children are getting meals during the regular school year at school. And in the summer, then if they're not attending summer school, the families are strapped a little bit more and looking at other resources.
Colano says a growing number of schools that qualify for 50% free and reduced lunch are setting up summer meal sites. She says any child 18 and under can get a free meal. In the last 6 years, Colano says the number of meals served has grown about 40% to roughly 3 million last year. The Wisconsin native who heads the Republican National Committee says it will be a little tougher to unify the GOP behind Donald Trump in the state. But Reince Priebus says it's still doable. Trump lost to Ted Cruz 48-35% in the state's April Republican primary, the state's largest GOP enclave. Jim Sensenbrenner's suburban Milwaukee House District gave Cruz a 35-point victory margin over Trump, which the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says is the largest losing margin for Trump in any U.S. House district where primary results are available. Sensenbrenner says he's concerned that a lot of his constituents will not vote in November. This is WPR News. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Zillow, where users can compare today's mortgage rates, find local lenders, and use calculators to estimate monthly mortgage payments and affordability. Zillow, find your way home. From Honda, maker of the restyled 2017 Accord Hybrid, with 212 horsepower and a 49-mile-per-gallon EPA city rating. Available now. Learn more at accord.honda.com. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Leaders of the European Union are insisting that the United Kingdom's exit from the EU should proceed in an orderly way, though it's still unclear on what terms Britain will part company with its EU partners. That's a big worry for small EU countries with citizens working in the UK. NPR's Corey Flintoff has this report through the eyes of one young migrant.
Here in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, it seems that everyone knows someone who lives and works in the UK. Official British statistics put the number of Lithuanians there at nearly 150,000. That's equal to about 5% of Lithuania's total population. I took an informal sample in Vilnius by stopping people on the street and asking them if they'd ever spent time in Britain. It didn't take long to meet Tikas Radzavicius, who says Brexit is a big concern for him.
Because I studied in England for 4 years, and so now I'm back in Lithuania for the summer, but I was actually thinking of going back to London to start a job there. And since last week's events, I'm not sure if I will do it.
Radzavicius is a 23-year-old who majored in finance. He says one immediate reason for his uncertainty about Britain is money.
First of all is the crash of the pound sterling, because now the value is depreciating, which obviously would make my earnings in Britain worth less.
Overseas work is extremely important for young Lithuanians because their home economy can't provide enough jobs for them. Their earnings are important for their country, too. Analysts estimate that Lithuanian workers abroad send home more than $300 million a year. For Radzavicius, though, there's another important issue. He says he's been talking with international friends back in the UK who say that the atmosphere has become tense since the Brexit campaign.
In the sense that racial slurs on the streets or offensive writings on the walls and stuff like that, that it's become much more common because somehow the racist or xenophobes in the country, they feel that after the referendum, they are somehow justified in becoming vocal about their views.
Radzavicius says he's experienced different kinds of anti-migrant attitudes.
There are the working class, less educated Brits who have no problems in saying out loud that Lithuanians go back to your country or Poles go back to your country. And I've heard that myself while I was working in bars and restaurants across the UK. But there is a different type of discrimination which is not as obvious because the more educated British people, they will never say it to your face that I'm not very happy about you being here, but behind your back they can say whatever they like and they will never become very close friends with you just because they might have this personal opinion that, you know, Britain is for British people.
Radzavicius says his plans for seeking a job in the UK are up in the air now.
What I was specifically looking for was either the banking industry or the consulting industry. The UK hopefully will still remain open to me as a labor market after the withdrawal process is done.
But he worries that Britain's banking industry will suffer as a result of its break with the UK, and that may cost him his chance of starting a long-term career there. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Vilnius.
And on a day Americans celebrate leaving the United Kingdom, we've been hearing variations on Morning Edition's theme music, unique arrangements by listeners. This rock version comes to us from a very close listener, someone who has heard our regular theme a lot, our program's technical director, Brian Jarbo. This is NPR News.
It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock on this Independence Day, and you are listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. The Marketplace Morning Report's coming up next. And then after that, shortly after 9 o'clock, it's classical music on Morning Classics. Plenty of patriotic music today here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Career opportunities abound in marketing, including public relations, advertising, promotion, and international marketing. Improve your degree through an articulation agreement with one of 35 colleges and universities. Check out marketing at gtc.edu.
Reception and book signing with the author and inspirational speaker. WPR is proud to promote engaging community events. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
It will be partly cloudy today in Wisconsin with highs in the mid to upper 70s, except in the lower 70s around Lake Michigan. And tonight, partly cloudy with lows dropping down to the lower to mid 60s. For tomorrow, do expect rain showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support for classical music comes from Piasecki Althaus Grief Share, a 13-week support group for adults grieving loss. Sessions held Wednesdays, August 3rd through October 26th at 5:30. Registration $20. You're invited to call 658-4101.
The Brexit vote could mean a big corporate tax break.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Zillow, where users can discover millions of homes for sale and for rent, from modern apartments to historic homes. Zillow, whatever home means to you, we'll help you find it.
From Marketplace in New York, I'm Mark Garrison, in for David Brancaccio. A key UK leader is proposing a major tax cut for corporations, taking the rate under 15% from the current 20%. The news comes from a Financial Times interview with George Osborne, Chancellor of the Exchequer, the UK's top finance position. That is a larger cut than was planned before the vote. BBC economics correspondent Andrew Walker explains why Brexit has Osborne aiming for a bigger tax cut.
He wants to make the point that Britain is very much open for business despite the referendum result. And the big fear among people who thought that a vote to leave the European Union would have an adverse impact on the British economy was mainly, not only, but mainly in the short term at least, focused on investment. The thought that businesses would be more concerned about what sort of trade access they would have in the future and that they might therefore delay or perhaps even cancel investment plans. Now, the idea of cutting corporation taxes even further, I think, is to give some sort of financial incentive to offset that disincentive that might be coming to investment from the uncertainty.
The BBC's Andrew Walker. Shareholders of the London Stock Exchange want to link up with Germany's Deutsche Börse. They voted overwhelmingly today to back the $27 billion merger. And let's do the numbers. Stocks are down, seeing some real lower levels in Europe. In the UK, shares are down 0.6%. In Germany, down 0.5%. U.S. markets are closed, of course, for the July 4th holiday. More bad news for electric car maker Tesla. The company now says it fell short of its target on delivering vehicles again. This after news that federal safety officials are investigating a fatal crash involving a Tesla car in self-driving mode. An influential group of local leaders is taking a new approach toward demographic change. The U.S. Conference of Mayors has launched what it's calling the Latino Alliance to tackle issues facing that community in American cities. From the Marketplace desk at OPB, Mitchell Hartman reports.
New evidence of Latinos' political clout comes from U.S. Census data just released. Hispanics now make up 17.5% of U.S. population, up from 16% just since 2010. Tom Cochran of the U.S. Conference of Mayors says the Latino Alliance wants to make sure those census numbers aren't undercounting Hispanics and shortchanging cities.
Because if people are living in your city and they need health care and they need this and they need that, and there are federal grants coming down, it's unfair for cities to have to take care of those people using our regular funding.
And Texas economist Ray Perryman says his research shows undocumented immigrants mostly work on the books and aren't a drain on government coffers.
In fact, the federal government makes that very well because there's a lot of taxes paid and very few benefits paid back.
One thing the mayors can't do, move comprehensive immigration reform. That's up to Congress, which is firmly gridlocked on the issue. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Chances are pretty good that you know someone who cut gluten from their diet. The NPD group says about 30% of Americans are trying to do that, though only a fraction of them are gluten intolerant. That is creating a whole new market, one that tech investors are betting big money on. Ashley Milne-Tite reports on a startup that's taken in millions to fund a portable allergen sensor.
Shireen Yates was fed up of being at an event or dinner, not knowing whether the food in front of her was genuinely gluten-free. She has the kind of intolerance where you really don't want to find out. Her company's called Nima. Its portable device lets diners test their food at the table, which she does all the time.
For the most part, wait staff and restaurants have been very, very accommodating. If it comes up positive for gluten for something that everyone thought was gluten-free, I've usually had my meal comped or taken away and asked if there's anything else I feel comfortable eating on the menu.
Everyone's happy, no lousy Yelp review. Mark Sorrells is a grain expert at Cornell University. He says the problem is...
Some people think they're sensitive to gluten when, in fact, it's other ingredients in foods that can cause problems.
And the device won't help them. But he says the truly afflicted could benefit when Nima starts shipping, even with the $200 price tag. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Malware Bytes. Small, medium, and enterprise businesses worldwide use Malware Bytes to remove malware and protect against advanced online threats. More at malwarebytes.com.
The holiday shopping season is probably pretty far from your mind as you're heading to the beach or grilling out before the fireworks, but for retailers, it began months ago when they had to start placing orders. What they sell after Thanksgiving can make or break their year. But as Marketplace's Rima Krace reports, predicting consumer tastes half a year ahead has never been harder.
I'm at a trendy boutique in Los Angeles called Black Market. The store's buyer, Han Nguyen, shows me around, pointing out high-waist swimsuits, gold necklaces, vegan leather handbags.
So if you step into our gift side here, we have a little bit of everything. We have hats, men's shoes.
Nguyen says she's already made her choices for the holiday season. In fact, she placed her last winter order on the day I visited.
Today, I ordered some Star Wars socks.
Which she loves.
Especially because my name is like Han, so I relate to like Han Solo.
Nguyen says Black Market sales were strong last holiday season, but that wasn't the case for a lot of companies. According to the National Retail Federation, sales grew by just 3%, below what was expected. Stacy Widlitz is president of SW Retail Advisors.
You know, retailers are going to look at their plan and say, you know, wow, we really need to go into the marketplace very lean because the consumer is just not biting.
Widlitz says over the last few years, retail companies have tried to make more conservative bets for the holiday season.
And it just seems to be not conservative enough.
So that leads to too much inventory, then big sales, and low margins. Morningstar analyst Bridget Weischer says another issue is the consumer has changed.
We've seen spend shift towards things like home items, travel,
restaurants, electronics,
basically more experience type stuff.
Clothing sales during the holiday season are the hardest things to predict, says Moody's retail analyst Charlie O'Shea.
There's obviously a lot of science here, but there's also a reasonable amount of luck involved when you plan for the holiday.
Take last winter, for example. He was sitting out in his back porch in New York sporting shorts and a T-shirt.
You know, you're not going to sell down coats at 50 off in that environment, much less 30 off, much less at full price.
But retailers can put off worrying about that for a few months. Right now, they need to think about spring 2017. I'm Rima Krace for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Mark Garrison with the Marketplace Morning Report. from APM, American Public Media.
And you heard it on WPR. There's more news for you today, including hourly broadcasts. We have the BBC News Hour at 3, and then All Things Considered at 4. Or listen on demand with the free WPR app and find stories at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from Al Johnson Swedish Restaurant in Sister Bay, home of Scandinavian cuisine, Swedish pancakes with lingonberries, and goats grazing the sod roof. Open daily from 6 to 8. AlJohnsons.com.
Support comes from the Racine Symphony, celebrating its 85th season with its annual gala at Wingspread, Saturday, August 6th. It's an evening of music, elegant hors d'oeuvres, and beverages against the serene backdrop of the Wingspread landscape. To reserve a seat or a table, call 636-9285.
You're listening to WGTD HD.